I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Cinematic Universe, a podcast that's all about comic book movies, which you can find at cinematicmultiverse.com. I'm Joe Cunningham, and joining me to help make sense of the comics behind the movies are...
Seb Patrick.
And James Hunt.
We'll discuss the latest comic book movie and TV news before diving into our spoiler-filled discussion of Rod Hardy's 1998 TV movie, Nick Fury, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But before any of that, I'm going to ask Seb and James to, well, not specifically explain a comic book concept, because for you listeners, it might seem like we've been away for a couple of weeks, but this is the first time that we've all been around a microphone talking to each other in, what, about 2 months, guys?
Yeah, something like that. It's been a long time.
Not since we recorded The Batman Returns, which was a pre-record before Suicide Squad, even. So basically, I've been out of the country for, a good few weeks. I've missed a lot of stuff. Guys, in the world of comic books, what have I missed? What should I be reading? What's going on? This is just an excuse for you to recommend some good comics. I thought you'd enjoy it.
I mean, I was talking to Seb about this off mic, and at the moment I am reading fewer comics than at any point in the last, 20 years. I can't keep up with how expensive they are for a start. And
Because of Brexit,
I bought 4 comics from Forbidden Planet at the weekend, and it cost me over £15. That is ridiculous money.
Comics prices haven't gone up yet, though.
I am not a trillionaire.
I went into my local comic book shop earlier this week, and I was kind of asking him a similar question. He was like, yeah, I'm reading kind of 1 DC title and 2 Marvel titles right now, and that's it. Monthly. And this is the guy that runs the shop. What are you reading, though, James? Is there anything of those 4 comics? I mean, you spent the money. There must be something worth it.
I mean, you already read them, I think, if you want to. I'm reading Howard the Duck, which is about to finish. And I'm reading Amazing Spider-Man. And I'm reading Silver Surfer. So,
are you not reading Squirrel Girl?
Am I not? No, I buy Squirrel Girl when it goes on sale, because I find it a bit much to remember, week in, week out, because I'm not invested in the character that much. So I enjoy it more when I read it in big chunks. I mean, that's true of a lot of books, really. That's kind of what's pushed me off monthly stuff.
Is it fair to say that you've sidestepped DC's Rebirth then?
Yeah, I'm still taking a kind of
wait and see.
Well, no, it's more like the whole Watchmen thing just made me think I'll just fuck DC. I'll probably calm down a bit, but I don't want any complicity in that act.
Okay, so this is kind of counter to the wider comic book world, though, because I was reading an article this week on Vulture that was saying that comic books or Diamond's distribution is higher than it's been in 20 years or something. It was the highest month for comic book sales in 20 years. So, Seb, you must be buying a whole heap of them.
Yeah, I've been pleasantly surprised by quite a lot of Rebirth. I've been pleased that I haven't loved everything that I tried, because it would be really bad for my bank balance if I had. But I have been, I mean, notwithstanding the what James said about, how it's got its origins in what appears to be an ill-advised attempt to fold Watchmen into things, and notwithstanding the fact that off the page I do still have concerns about some of the ways in which DC is run, some of the people who are there, it really annoys me that one of the in terms of creativity, one of the best editorial offices at the moment is the Superman office, and the Superman office has a group editor who... I mean, we won't go into that on this podcast, but you can look up some of the stuff about, yeah. But, taking all of that aside, I've tried a lot of the DC Rebirth books at their first issue. Not all of them have been great. Some of them have been surprisingly slightly disappointing, but more have been surprisingly excellent. So on the Superman side of things, Action Comics has been okay. Superman, the Superman title has been fantastic by Peter Tomasi and Patrick Gleason, the artist. They've worked together on like Green Lantern and stuff like that before. So that's bringing the pre-Flashpoint Superman into continuity to replace the new 52 Superman who's dead. And it's about his son discovering his powers and basically becoming the new Superboy. And it's been excellent. So tonally well judged and just like feels like the Superman character that I want to read about. They've also had a Superwoman book that threatened to be about the new 52 Lois Lane, but actually seems to be about Lana Lang instead. It had kind of had a bit of a twist at the end of the first issue, which the first issue was better than the second. I don't know if I'm sticking with that yet. A completely new series called New Superman with a hyphen in it, so hyphenated like Spider-Man. Which has been, for me, the real revelation of DC Rebirth. It's by Jean Luen Yang, who did a very disappointing run on Superman earlier this year or last year. But this is about a Chinese kid called Kanan Kong, who, as a result of a government experiment, gets superpowers and becomes the Chinese Superman, basically. But it's played quite as sort of like, not exactly a humour book, but like not dissimilar in tone to something like Giffen and DeMatteis's Justice League or Keith Giffen's Blue Beetle from like the mid-2000s. The thing that distinguishes it is that the lead character isn't very likeable, but you can see that he's got depth and will probably become more likeable. I mean, the best way I've seen it summarised is, imagine if it was Flash Thompson that got bitten by the spider instead of Peter Parker. The first few issues of that have been great, really, really enjoyable, so I strongly recommend that. There's a new Supergirl book by Steve Orlando, which has just started, which is really weird because it mixes the character of the new 52 Supergirl, who's very different from the Melissa Benoist TV show, but it puts her in a setting that's much more in line with the TV show. Like, so she's got the Danvers as her adoptive parents, who are DEA agents, and Cat Grant is in it, and like all things that weren't elements of the New 52 run.
Yeah.
But with a character who is very much alien girl trying to understand like Earth and her place on it and stuff. So that's worked reasonably well so far. So the Superman
in my Comixology account ready yeah. to be read at some it's good. Point when I've yeah. caught up on everything I missed when I was away. Seb, because I imagine we probably can't go into that level of detail with all of the Rebirth books. One question I was desperate to get answered is, if you're reading Rebirth mm-hmm. and you want to actually keep up with the kind of wider Rebirth, like the overarching story of Rebirth that was mm-hmm. teed up in that first issue with Wally West
yeah.
flying around, what comics should you actually be reading if you want to? Because I've read bits of Wonder Woman and Batman, and it doesn't seem to be really in there.
I haven't seen anything beyond the fact that the only thing that I've seen in terms of an ongoing story is there is a mysterious character called Mr. Oz, who some people think is going to be Ozymandias, but I really don't. I think that's a stupid idea. And he seems to be collecting characters for some purpose, and he's talked about... you know, there's all these things about rifts in the kind of timeline and the continuity not being as it should be. There's things like the Three Jokers, which hasn't really been expanded on in the Batman books. Now, so far, two of the books that I've been reading have had Mr. Oz show up in them. One of them was Action Comics, because he collected Doomsday at the end of a story arc there. And the other one is Detective Comics. But something happened in Detective Comics that I don't want to spoiler, but it related to that. I don't want to spoiler it because it's a major thing to a major character. The other
it's
reason
only
is,
just come out as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, it was just week. Last week as we record this. I don't want to go into too much detail about every book that I'm reading and why they're good, but Detective Comics is the best of the Rebirth books. It is phenomenal. Right. It's a really, really great series. Tom King's Batman is very good as well, and I think he's going to get better and better. But
I'm reading that.
Detective Comics is superb. Team book with just loads of great characters in it, and highly recommend that. And Green Arrow is the other one. Green Arrow, the Rebirth issue was the best, and the subsequent issues have been okay, but I do recommend Green Arrow as well.
And just because I want to hear you talk about it a little bit, you on Twitter the other day said that Vision might be Marvel's best new book in about 20 years. Was
yeah.
that right?
It's just... And yeah, you want me to say this because you were reading it before I was.
I picked up the first issue and I can't believe that I've been reading something this good as it's been happening.
Because the thing is, because Tom King like had done some quite good stuff at DC. He'd been doing Grayson at DC, which was good, but it wasn't like one of the best things I'd ever read. But I hear that Omega Men, which I need to pick up the trade of that he did at DC, was supposed to be fantastic. And Vision is just, like, if anyone listening to this doesn't, like, know about the Vision and why it's good, it's just, I can't even, well, tell you what, I mean, Joe, you describe why it's good, because you were reading it before me. But I will agree with you that it's just an amazing, amazing comic.
It's not in any way a trad superhero book. It's set in the American suburbs. You don't really have to be invested or care about Vision at all, because it is more about his wider family. And almost the most the key character in it is the narrator, I would say. Mm. Like that's where all
it's got a really clever third party narration trick that it pulls from time to time.
Yeah.
That's kind of it's sort of basically it's referring to everything in the past, and it's like this is an omniscient narrator who knows what's going to happen at the end of the story, and it's building to something.
And it's from the word go, it's set up as a tragic story, and so you kind of know, but yet it seems to kind of plug deeper depths by the time you get to the end of an issue, even though you know where it's going. It seems to be even more depressing than you thought it was going to be in terms of the story, but really, really compelling and entertaining, and manages to tell issue-to-issue stories whilst having a really tightly focused arc across the whole thing.
When I said about it being potentially the best thing that Marvel have done, I thought about it in terms of, like, there's Marvel books that I love. Like, I love Squirrel Girl, and I've really enjoyed a lot of Howard the Duck, and there's been lots of Marvel stuff over the last 10, 15 years that I think has been fantastic and that I've really enjoyed. But this feels like, when it finishes, it's going to finish after 12 issues, partly, I think, because it's completing its story and partly because Tom King has gone exclusive to DC. It is going to have told a self-contained story that I genuinely think in years and years to come, people are going to be talking about as one of the great comic series. That's how good I think it is. It's just not enough people are paying attention to it now, but I really think thought of in those terms.
I think I might have mentioned this on the podcast before, but the fill-in issue that has it in the middle, where it has a different artist, where it kind of flashes back.
Is that the Scarlet Witch one?
Yeah, the Scarlet Witch.
Oh, because I just read that one because I was behind on it, and oh my god, and then the way that what that drops on you at the end of that issue is just like my head exploded at that point.
This is making me want to read it.
When I'm reading fill-in issues sometimes with comics, and especially like when I'm kind of catching up, maybe it's a recommendation you've given me and it's 12 issues, but like maybe the seventh one is a fill-in.
Superior Foes of Spider-Man did that.
It was almost the best thing in the entire series.
Yeah, that issue was just like a mind blower. Yeah,
yeah.
In terms of shedding light on the series, it's fantastic. And that is why I'd say at the moment Tom King's Batman has been slightly overshadowed by Detective Comics, but I think in the long run, based on Vision, I can imagine him building something really, really special there. He's bringing a slightly different, definitely a different feel to it from Scott Snyder, but kind of it feels a little bit more Grant Morrison-y, some of what he's doing, but in a different way. I think he's got a head full of big ideas. So yeah, that's going to be interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Well, excellent. So we've talked about a lot of good comics there. So hopefully, listeners will maybe want to pick up some of those or try some of those. And it sounds like James might want to try at least one of them.
Oh, can I also as well, best thing going at Image at the moment, well, there are a few great things going at Image at the moment, but best new thing at Image is The Fix by Nick Spencer and Steve Lieber, the Superior Foes of Spider-Man.
Yeah, I am reading that.
Yeah, that's everything you would expect from Superior Foes of Spider-Man, but being allowed to be more over the top. Is basically
I read the first issue of that and something made me laugh out loud in a public space, so that was always good. And Paper Girls is excellent, but every hipster comic book reader is already reading that anyway, so
I'm not. I didn't get on with it, but yeah.
Oh really?
Yeah.
The start of the second arc is fantastic.
I may catch up on it.
It kind of kicks up a notch, so yeah. Okay, well, we'll move on to this week's comic book movie and TV news now, and listeners who listen to the mini-sodes, or this week the mega-sode, will know that I covered a lot of news this week. And there hasn't been a huge amount that has broken between then and when we're recording this podcast. But there's a couple of little things that probably aren't going to need too deep a discussion, but I think it would be interesting to talk about. The one that I think we can talk about the most, guys, because you might have some thoughts and theories about what's going on here, is that the Punisher Netflix series is obviously gearing up for development because it's made... it's cast one of its villains. And it's cast Ben Barnes, who is probably still best known for playing Prince Caspian in the Narnia movies. And it's suspected that he's the villain. And now what's interesting to me here is what this says about where the Punisher is in the development of the Netflix series, that it might be before a Daredevil season 3, or potentially that this Punisher villain is going to be introduced in the Defenders before he shows up in his own series. So what I want you guys to tell me is who he might be playing, who would make sense as a Punisher villain, and what you think about this casting.
Well, I didn't really know much about this, but I'm just having Googled it. I'm just reading an article on Screen Rant, which suggests that the rumor is that he's going to play Bobby Saint.
Who, I saw this as well.
Who is not from the comics, and who is, for those of you who didn't listen to our Punisher episode, he is the son of John Travolta's character in the Thomas Jane film, and he dies at the start. Like, it's his death, it's him getting killed by the Punisher that basically kicks off the plot of the film.
That is he the twin that gets killed, or is he the twin that survives?
He's the twin who gets killed at the start.
Wow. That is such an odd choice. It makes me think they might have inside information, because I can't see any reason you would pull that character if you didn't have, like, casting sheet or something.
Who would predict that? Who would predict that Bobby Saint, not even Howard Saint, yeah, who was the villain?
Yeah.
Unless they've read Bobby on a page and got confused, is there a Bobby character Punisher that they could have pulled from?
There aren't any obvious Punisher villains except for the, like, Nucci family.
Or if you brought in, like, there are kind of, I'm thinking in the Ennis run, maybe there are military generals and stuff who are... isn't there one major military general? I mean, he seems a bit young for that, but, like, you could imagine a figure from Frank's past in the military, you know, well, potentially...
I don't want to spoil Daredevil, but they sort of did that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
See, I haven't watched
it. I mean, the only Punisher villain who I'm expecting to see is Jigsaw. I'm not sure if he'll be Jigsaw. So,
the only other Punisher villain I can think of is Barracuda, and he's not going to be him.
Who's Jigsaw then? If we're expecting to see him, who is he for our listeners and for me?
He's basically a guy Frank disfigured. He chucked him through a plate glass window and, like, screwed up his face, and as a result, he's just like a nutcase with a gun.
Would
that make sense then for a kind of a pretty boy actor like Ben? I say that very dismissively, but Ben Barnes is a very handsome, kind of boyish, good looking man. So would that make sense? Does this casting kind of chime with that character?
I mean, I guess, like, Jigsaw's thing is just that his face has been stitched up and wrecked. So, you know, if they're going for the dramatic irony of this pretty guy who's got heavy prosthetics or acquires them by the end of the series, then maybe. But, like, he's just like a hitman who the Punisher has a sort of feud with, and that's the extent of him being, like, the archenemy of the character. He is called Billy, though, so, I mean, it's possible if, you know, Billy Bobby is not a huge stretch.
It's just Bobby Saint seems like such an insane thing.
If it turns out to be Bobby Saint, they had the inside track on that, because there's no reason to select that character. None whatsoever.
But does the Punisher have iconic villains, or does it really not matter? So could they take a character like Jigsaw and just do something a little bit different with it?
The thing about the Punisher is his whole deal is that he murders people. So it's hard to have a villain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, like, at the centre of his concept is he kills people who he doesn't like. and he's ruthless about it. So, like, Bullseye is a good foil for the Kingpin. Bullseye is a good foil. The Kingpin's a good foil. Because, like, those are characters who are important enough to other Marvel characters that the Punisher can't beat them. Yeah. But if you create a villain for the Punisher, like, they're ending up dead eventually. Like, all the good ones are, like, the Nucci's and the Russian, probably. Like, that's the extent of it.
Just bring back the Russian completely from... If you're going to take one character from the Thomas Jane Punisher film, just bring back that version of the Russian. Seb, what do you reckon then? Because I'm now wondering from what James says, if the Punisher thing is that he kills characters, what if... Would it make sense to introduce a character in Defenders, maybe, that the Punisher kind of rubs up against, or that kind of, you know, they clash and then you bring him back? Because it's very difficult to hint at any backstory when he kills everyone.
I mean, this is the thing with the Punisher. You can only really go one of two ways with his villains. You either have him come up against somebody who is trying to bring him to task for his crimes, or you put him up against somebody who's worse than he is.
I imagine if they did Detective Soap.
Yeah.
Oh, please.
Oh, I read him in the comic. Yeah, he was the hapless kind of idiot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or he could be, there's also Nicky Cavella from Garth Ennis's run, who's the mob guy, who, the more I think about it, actually, he's the kind of youngish psychopath guy, and I think is kind of quite suave, so that could be a Ben Barnes kind of thing. But
I don't in a million years think they're going to do anything like this, but I would love to see them just do a Punisher series where they bring in one of the other heroes as the villain. But so obviously the villain is the hero in that sense, but you are watching a series from the Punisher's point of view where, say, I don't know, Iron Fist is trying to bring him down for the entire series.
But I mean, if you're doing that, surely Daredevil is the one.
Well, that's the thing, they've already done the Daredevil confrontation, haven't they? Those are the two.
I mean, in terms of setting superhero characters against each other, those are pretty much the best two that you can...
The major Punisher pairings are like Punisher and Daredevil, Punisher and Spider-Man, Punisher and Wolverine. So two of those you can't really do.
Two of those are not going to happen.
Yeah. just have Charlie Cox in as the villain for the Punisher series.
Yeah, I would watch that. I think because I mean
you kind of did watch it though. That's the problem, isn't it? Like the first four episodes of Daredevil series 2.
But I mean, I do remember the first season of Daredevil where everyone was saying, this is good, but it would be better if it was called Kingpin.
Yeah.
And obviously, I agree with that. So I think it would be interesting to do a series called Punisher, where your villain is a hero. but yeah. Okay, well, we'll see whether Ben Barnes turns out to be Bobby Saint or whether he turns out to be someone completely different. But yeah, that is... If that's true, wow. We'll move on now to some DC news, and we're definitely getting that Harley Quinn movie, you guys.
Surprising nobody.
Yeah, surprising nobody, but I think what will be interesting to see is how DC fit these movies in, because they've now announced a solo Batman movie, a solo Harley Quinn movie, and a Man of Steel sequel that's in amongst all of the other films that they've already announced. At this point, can I make a Justice League Part 2 when they say we're getting it.
My speculative guess would be, aside from maybe The Flash, I would think they would be far more likely to make the further Batman, Superman, Harley Quinn and Wonder Woman movies than they would be to make movies with new characters at this point. Like, we are never going to see a Green Lantern movie in this universe at this rate. There's no reason for them to take a chance on it.
That's a very obvious one to get pushed back. Aquaman is happening.
Yeah, true. Aquaman is going to go ahead. I can't see Cyborg happen. If anything's going to be a casualty, it's going to be Cyborg at this point.
Yeah.
Are they really going to cancel the black character? That's not a good look, is it?
It's not, but it is Cyborg, so...
See, I think the obvious one to get rid of right now is Justice League Part 2, and you do it. You do another Justice League movie, but you save it for another 2 or 3 years and push Green Lanterns back.
The problem with that is you're asking Zack Snyder to be sort of concise.
You're on the only assumption here that Zack Snyder is going to direct another film after Justice League, which...
I can't believe he's directing Justice League. Like, what does he have on Warner?
Well, I think what he had was a start date that was too soon after Batman v Superman.
Alan Smithy was unavailable.
But the Harley Quinn movie, you guys, well, that's going to be exec produced by Margot Robbie. So
Harley Quinn will definitely have trousers.
With Harley Quinn, I think the interesting thing is going to be, will they now move Harley completely away from the Joker? Given that Jared Leto seems to be hurriedly burning... Well, one, he's burning his bridges, and two, I don't think anyone has a desperate desire to see him back. So there's a really good opportunity to let Harley move away. And the obvious thing to do is bring Poison Ivy in.
Yes.
You know, if they're going to move in a sensible direction with the Harley Quinn movie, you bring in Ivy. Now, what I would suggest doing is bring in Ivy as an antagonist who then becomes an ally by the end of it. So set her up as the main villain, but establish that rapport between them. You know, maybe, you know, it would be good if they did, but maybe don't go full pelt on the actual full-on relationship, because, you know, this is American movies that we're talking about, so there's only so far you can go. But, you know, without offending half the country, although it's Harley Quinn, so presumably they're not bothered about that. But, I think
this is one of the films that, for unsavoury reasons, they could get away with going full pelt on that.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You also, you don't want to go to, you know, the whole point of why that relationship has worked in comics is because it actually isn't pitched at teenage boys. But even so, like, that, the point is that there is another hook for Harley that you can move her in that direction. You don't, like, she is not as reliant on the Joker as she was as a character, even like 5 years ago, let alone 10, you know.
And there's no denying how popular this version of the character has been. The amount of people I've already seen dressed up in Harley Quinn outfits for, like, Halloween.
I think
over a month away from Halloween.
I think there's a reasonable case to be made that she is by far the most popular female character in comics to the general public. Like,
Well, that character is already iconic in the way that Heath Ledger's Joker was, in a completely different way, but it's perhaps even more impressive because that's come about in a movie that is an absolute clusterfuck.
Well, this is, I mean, you know, that, yeah, because, I mean, as we've discussed, you know, that film can't be considered a flop now. Like, that film has done what DC wanted it to.
Oh, no, it was never a flop from the opening weekend. It succeeded.
But, you know, from a, even if you were looking at it from a critical point of view, like, I think the thing that everyone agrees upon is that Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn is the one thing that comes out of the film not damaged by it. Mm-hmm. In much the same way as coming out of Batman v Superman, everyone was like, well, yeah, we still want to see a Ben Affleck solo Batman film.
Yeah. I mean, I do wonder whether, again, an obvious film not to make is Suicide Squad 2. You replace Suicide Squad 2 with Harley Quinn and you put Deadshot in something else. Because I think as much as people like Will Smith, I don't think it was Will Smith and Margot Robbie's relationship on screen there, which was
yeah,
what everyone,
they were just the only
for.
Two who were better than the material.
Yeah, so you put Deadshot in a Batman movie, or you put Deadshot in a Justice League movie, or even a Flash movie, or I doubt any of the others. Probably, I'm sure you could stick him in anything. You could almost make him kind of like the Coulson of that universe, who kind of pops up here, there, and everywhere because. You know, who, maybe you could be a hero for hire rather than like a kind of an assassin for hire. Now that he's got those Amanda Waller links, but yeah, I'd love to see a Harley Quinn movie because that's the thing with DC. Like, as long as, and that's the thing with shared universes, it kind of doesn't matter if you fuck up time and time again. If there is a thing about those movies that people like. That's why I always find it's a shame in the Marvel movies where, like, they get the movies right, but occasionally they'll get a character right, and I'm just like, I kind of feel like that character's ruined for the universe now.
That's why Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was, like, pulling in all sorts of no-hopers from the comics.
Yes, exactly.
And they're not even doing them properly, just in case Marvel proper studios wanted them.
On a related note, we can cover the final piece of news as part of this discussion. Zack Snyder debuted the new Batman suit, the new Batman tactical suit, which I don't think is going to be his suit all the way through Justice League. But what do you guys think about Batman dressing as Night Owl in Justice League?
Well, you've just said it there. It's a Night Owl costume. I mean, it literally is Night Owl's head. It's ridiculous.
I mean, it's just an action figure thing, isn't it? Like, that's all that's going on here.
To be fair, I mean, you can't complain about Batman movies introducing new suits for action figures because they've been doing.
Oh yeah, I'm not complaining. I'm just saying, like, you know.
What did you guys think? I previewed a theory on the Megasode that the DC movies are doing the same thing with Watchmen that Rebirth has. So we've got quite a lot of the Watchmen actors have been cast in the DC universe now. Now Batman's dressing as Night Owl. I think there's a big meta narrative going on, which is that DC learned all the wrong lessons from Watchmen, which is they hired Zack Snyder to make their films.
Yeah.
They wanted to make them dark and gritty. They changed from the source materials in ways that they shouldn't. And it's a big meta-narrative that's going on, and we're going to find out eventually that Watchmen is to blame for all of this again. And we're living in a fake universe.
I think it's just Zack Snyder's attempt to give Alan Moore like a rage-induced heart attack.
Ah, okay. Well, that's all the comic book movie news for this week.
Much more professional than usual, that.
What are you trying to say? But yeah, we're going to move on now to our spoiler-filled discussion of the 1998 TV movie Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. You guys listen to this because we had to watch the whole movie.
From the pages of entertainment history, from a brand renowned for non-stop action adventure, from a name that stirs the imagination, from a universe where good is heroic and evil sets the screen ablaze, comes a man who will always remain a hero.
Welcome to S.H.I.E.L.D., the Supreme Headquarters International Espionage Law Enforcement Division.
Nick, take care.
Isn't that sweet? His last words, Nick. I assume he meant his boyhood chum, Nick Fury. Well, rest assured, your friend's death is only the beginning.
Fury! Managed to screw things up again?
Listen carefully. I'm addressing S.H.I.E.L.D. Director Chuck Pinter. Death's head virus has been set to explode somewhere in Manhattan. You have until 6 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time tomorrow to assemble $1 billion. Any attempt to evacuate Manhattan will result in the immediate release of the virus. Against Hydra, there is no S.H.I.E.L.D.
Fury, what do you think you're doing? You're endangering the mission! You comic book coward!
Give us the coordinates, Tim.
We have two service-to-air missiles being launched.
All right, let's move. We're going to have two heat seekers up our exhaust. Hang on, people! Bail out! Grab your gear!
You located the suspect vehicle yet?
Sir, I have the sight now.
30 minutes to the deadline.
This is Hydra headquarters.
Long S.H.I.E.L.D. in the way of New York.
Nick, thank God. I thought you were dead.
I was, but now I'm better.
You must get us the abort code.
The abort code.
Fury! You're too late!
Okay, so that was a little glimpse into the world of Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Because, Seb, you said this to us before the podcast. You were like, should we explain this movie a lot more than we normally do? Because a lot less people are going to have watched this than the normal stuff we talk about. I think that was
even less than Howard the Duck
prediction. Yes, even less than Howard the Duck. Well, this is a TV movie for a start, and it's what's the best word to describe it?
I mean, I would say, well, actually, no, I'll tell you the best way to describe it. Although I already did this on Twitter, so apologies for those who read that already. But the best way that I can find to sum up this film is that it is basically a real-life version of Michael Scott's Threat Level Midnight. But potentially even less competent.
It's such a bizarre movie because from all I can tell from kind of little bits of Googling and from Wikipedia and from my limited Marvel knowledge, this is fairly faithful, like maybe one of the most faithful comic book adaptations of all time.
Yeah. It's faithful in the sense that they really did go through and take all of the characters' names from the comic. I mean, that's about as far as it goes. But no, because they get the names. They do the helicarrier. They do, you know, they do life model decoys. It's like...
Yeah.
I genuinely think, like, Hasselhoff is a recognisable Nick Fury. Like, if you didn't tell someone that it was Nick Fury, and even Eyepatch notwithstanding, like, he is a solid version of the character, to the point of he just kind of spouts cheesy tough guy one-liners and does cheesy tough guy things like shooting lift panels.
We should point out as well, original white Nick Fury, because this will have been pre the Ultimate Universe and pre the black Sam Jackson inspired Nick Fury.
So like there, like I was saying to Seb before, this is something that will come up again later, but there is a character in Marvel who is a parody of Nick Fury. And this version of the character is almost more like him than actual Nick Fury. But at the same time, that parody only works because Nick Fury is already ridiculous. So, like, the fact that Hasselhoff is, like, acting over the top and given bad dialogue and stupid actions is completely consistent with Nick Fury and his place in the Marvel Universe.
I think it's just that, in terms of who the characters are and what the setup is, and even to an extent what the plot is, and even some of the relationships between the characters, it does draw quite heavily on the Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. comics, but you know, particularly the 60s stuff. What it's lacking is the tone and imagination of those comics. So rather than being a hugely imaginative spy 1960s stylish spy caper that just throws a million ideas at you and never lets up, it just takes those characters and puts them in the most horrendously generic 90s action movie. No, I wouldn't even call it an action movie, because an action movie implies that there would be some action in it. And there isn't.
It has all There's the trappings just a lot of an action talking. Movie, though, doesn't
oh,
it?
Oh, it totally has all the trappings of an action movie.
It's an action movie for TV. And that's what I was going to say. Like, it feels like a Steven Seagal movie, but, like, not a Steven Seagal movie of the 90s, a Steven Seagal movie of, like, 2014. Like, after Seagal had got chubby and not interested and didn't have the budgets anymore.
Yeah, you do have to, I suppose you do have to think about it in terms of being a TV movie, and that does mean that you do have to look at it with slightly different critical faculties. But I still think that a TV movie can either, like, objectively be good, or it can be really bad, but you just get this real sense of enjoyment out of it. And like, there's another famous comic book TV movie that I think we'll get to. Infamous comic book TV movie from the 90s, from a year before this, that I think we will get to eventually, which is probably objectively worse than this, but is, I think, a lot more enjoyable. The thing about this is that, like, even if you judge it by the lowered standards of a TV movie, it's just, like,
you see,
so
Seb,
inept.
I agree, it is inept and it's terrible, but I watched this with kind of like a disbelieving grin on my face the whole way through, because even when the scenes are boring, and the scenes are boring, Hasselhoff will just be acting his face off not acting with a capital A, just kind of like doing something ridiculous or saying something silly or just playing it so over the top. And the fact that the film kind of like veers between taking itself semi-seriously and sending itself up entirely, like the fact that it never has an idea about what it's doing, and the fact that the plot is so absurd that you don't quite know what ridiculous thing is going to happen in the next scene. Like, is Nick Fury dead? Oh no, he's not dead, but he kind of is, but he's going to make it through to the end of the movie. I just never knew what was coming next, and I never knew what Hasselhoff was going to have next. So I did have fun watching this. Like, I probably had the same amount of fun watching this as I did Howard the Duck, apart from that boring half hour in the middle when they're on the plane. Like, but I think that kind of enjoyment.
Howard the Duck makes, as we discussed in detail, makes some horrendously appalling decisions, but Howard the Duck is more competently made than this.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes, agreed. Yeah, correct. okay, well, I think that's a good way to tee this movie up. I'm going to read to you the plot synopsis from Wikipedia and see if we can expand on this. I should point out, we were originally going to record this episode before I went away. It was going to be another pre-record, and we eventually didn't have time to do it. But I did watch the film before I went away, and I was going to try and watch it again when I got back. But I didn't, so...
But you're a married man now, and, you've got responsibilities. Responsibilities.
I ended up watching, 20 episodes of Batman the Animated Series instead. So I'm going to read this plot synopsis from Wikipedia, and then we'll see if you can kind of expand on it and remind me of certain things, because I'm sure this is going to be a case where you're like, I remember when that happens, and I was like, I'd forgotten, but now I do, because I know, watching the film, I thought it was ridiculous from scene to scene. So, Nick Fury, retired... So he's retired at the start of the movie, you guys, is approached to return to duty and take down agents of the terrorist organisation Hydra, you've heard of them, led by the children of Baron Wolfgang von Strucker, again, we've heard of him, an old enemy of his. Hydra has reconstituted a pathogen known as the Death's Head virus. Is that a thing from the comics, you guys?
Not that I'm aware of.
There is a Death's Head in Marvel, but he's rather different.
Oh, maybe it's a reference then.
I don't think it's a reference.
And he threatens to attack Manhattan with it, barring payment of $1 billion. So we've got a Dr. Evil little bit here as well, which is quite nice. So can you expand on that? What happens in the gaps in between Nick Fury trying to take down Hydra and stop them releasing this pathogen?
A lot of people talk for a while. I mean, is there anything to the plot beyond that?
Not really, is there? Like, there's...
So it's basically, he gets pulled out of retirement.
Well, they've got Arnim Zola, haven't they? And
they've got Arnim Zola, but...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
God, yeah, there is that whole bit with Arnim.
Yeah, there's that bit where he's kidnapped off screen and you're not really sure that he's been kidnapped. And you rewind the film to go, did I miss the scene where someone kidnapped Arnim Zola? And then you realise, no, it happened when Nick Fury was unconscious, so we didn't see it.
The bit where they go to get Arnim Zola does give probably the only thing that I genuinely liked about this movie in terms of being self-aware, which is that it has a scene set in Berlin and somebody says to David Hasselhoff, we had some good times here, didn't we? Or maybe maybe even David Hasselhoff says, we had some good times here. As David Hasselhoff talking about having good times in Berlin, I can get behind that as a little meta joke.
Well, that's what I mean about it kind of veering between silly and, like, between being self-aware and being completely straight-faced. Like, sometimes you will just be watching a run-of-the-mill, standard kind of copy and paste from any action film scene where people are stood around in a room discussing the plot, Basil Exposition style. But you'll also have, like, a scene where, like, I don't know, someone... I'm sure at some point someone calls Nick Fury a comic book villain.
Yeah.
And kind of raises an eyebrow and looks
coward,
directly
down the
camera.
Which is weird, because it's not even a phrase.
And by the way, you guys, I'm just looking down the list of the characters, and I did this when I was watching the film as well. So, we've already mentioned that the children, the villains are the sons and the son and daughter, well, mostly the daughter of Baron von Strucker.
Yeah.
So we've got Andrea von Strucker, who I believe is a Marvel character, but so obscure that she's like from one particular actual Nick Fury comic, I think.
To be fair, Von Strucker's children are a fairly major pair of villains who turned up quite a lot in certain comics.
Okay.
Like, they used to go around as a pairing. Like, for a start, in the comics, they're mutants, and their powers are connected.
Oh, so we couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah. So they turn up in it.
So they are actual legit.
Yeah, they turn up in X-Men comics a lot, although Andrea von Strucker is dead now, and the who's the son?
Andreas.
Andreas, yeah, he's of course he's he became the new swordsman in the last run of Thunderbolts. A couple of runs of Thunderbolts ago.
In the film, he's not Andreas; he's Werner.
Werner is a different. No, yes. Werner's a different one.
Okay, well, in the film, it's Werner and Andrea.
Okay.
I'm looking at IMDb here. But,
right, and Andrea is also Viper. That's her
character. She's not Viper.
That is confusing, because there's a different character called Viper.
Completely different
like,
character.
That version is the one who was adapted in the Wolverine. So she's she was married to Wolverine, which is why she's tied up with the X-Men license. But she's not a mutant.
It's almost as if someone has picked up, like, a Marvel kind of encyclopedia and skip forward to this S.H.I.E.L.D. page and kind of flick through some articles and go, yeah, write that word down, write that character's name down, and then...
But apart from that, they do, like, the cast of characters that they put together, as I say, they are all, like, Val Fontaine, Dum-Dum Duggan, although he's just Timothy Duggan here.
Yes, he was the one that I had to pause halfway through the film, because I heard someone call him Duggan and I was like, ah, is that... But he's just kind of like an office bod.
Yeah, and
he's not a Howling Commando, is he?
And even the bloke who gets killed right at the start is Clay Quatermain, who is a major recurring one, and he's an Alias. Yes, you did recognise him from there then. they're missing what's his name? Villain from Winter Soldier. Help me out, James. Sitwell. They're missing Sitwell. But they do, speaking of villains from Winter Soldier, Alexander Pierce.
This actually...
But as kind of like a rookie... Oh, no, wait, I'm thinking the wrong character.
No, you are. No, Alexander Pierce is the English guy.
Yeah, he's like the British... The
rookie, yeah. Oh, yeah, so he's the rookie kind of S.H.I.E.L.D. agent who is learning under Fury, who clearly is the character who Fury is kind of like... Well, it seems like it has this standard narrative where Fury is going to kind of give him stick the whole way through, and at the end is going to rub his cheek and say, "You're done good, kid."
Well, that's exactly what happens.
Well, it is, but also, like, along the way, he shows himself to be fairly incompetent at various occasions. But, like, so he actually is the idiot for a lot of the time.
But you know
it's
what?
Not just that Fury's not respecting him because Fury's trying to be the tough old...
No, he's
actually rubbish.
To be fair, this is a closer to the comics portrayal of Pierce than Winter Soldier, because he's not a baddie in the comics. He is a team member in the comics. He's not from the 60s comics, though. He's from the... like late 80s, early 90s Nick Fury stuff. So he's not part of the original gang from the Lee and Kirby and Steranko stuff. But Duggan, Val Fontaine and Quatermain are all from that run. They're missing... there is... Gabe Jones is in it, isn't he? He's the guy who's not Morgan Freeman.
He's the doctor.
Is Gabe Jones as well. So, but he's kind of he's a very different character in the film than he is in the comics. He's another soldier.
What about the director, Jack Pincer? Has he just been made up because Fury tends to be the director, so they needed to put someone else
in? He doesn't sound
there.
Familiar to me.
I'm not sure if they created him for the film. I can't remember. I can't recall. I suspect he was created for the film.
Because it does...
The name doesn't ring a bell.
So we should point out, Nick Fury... In this film, because he's retired, but he's kind of been retired. It wasn't his choice, really, was it? He was replaced and sent off into the wilderness.
What's weird is he gets recalled, and I'm sure that when Pierce goes to him, he says, they want you to come back and be director. But then he comes back and there is a director who he reports to who hates him.
They say they say they want him to be the public director. So like the public face, okay. Perhaps. But not the not the actual face.
What?
But I do actually think it makes sense, because if this is kind of a pastiche of all of Nick Fury's elements dialed up to 11, I think it kind of makes sense that he has to be kind of the guy rebelling against the orders of someone above
him. There needs to be like an authority.
I guess you could have done it with like the president or the military kind of giving S.H.I.E.L.D. orders and him saying no.
I think what's weird is the reason why you kind of need that intermediary step or that intermediary level is they've established that the president wants Nick Fury to come back, but as you say, they want all this stuff where he's kind of rolling his eyes at it all and he's, you know, punching against authority literally in one instance. But you can't have it be the president who he's rebelling against, because the president wanted him there. So you have to have somebody between the president and him who doesn't want him there. Although I don't think the film would have been harmed in any way if that character had been cut out entirely, because with one very, very notable exception, I think that guy is the worst performance and character in the film.
Sorry, the general?
Yeah, he's so bad. Well,
and he gets two performances, because as you said, life model decoys, and we get a life model decoy of the general, the director in this film. And this was one of my favourite moments in the film, is so they're kind of this, the director's already in the room, and then this other one shows up and kind of storms into the room, and like, as a viewer, you're like, well, obviously this new one showing up is the decoy, because it's kind of been set up that way and the one in the room is real. And Fury kind of, with no hesitation, picks up his gun and kind of shoots the life model decoy and takes him out. And you're like, it can't be this obvious. They're going to subvert this line somehow. And the director says to Fury, how did you know which one was real? I didn't. Wait, is that the joke? Wait, that is the joke. It was entirely what we expected.
Okay, let's
I can't believe that by this point you expected it to subvert the line. Well, this is a film that by that state, like within its first maybe 30 minutes or so, the words "so we meet again" had been uttered twice by two different characters on two different occasions.
That's after...
What I do like is as well, though...
That's after he fixes a lift security system by shooting it. Like, there are a lot of times in this film where he just, like, pulls his gun and starts shooting. Because he's like, well, I'm going to fix this the old-fashioned way. Bullets. I mean, it gives me new appreciation of the Howard the Duck movie. I tell you what, though, it has genuinely given me new appreciation of the Generation X TV movie, which I think is a lot better than this, in that it has a coherent story and actual characters and, you know, scenes you would conceivably remember.
So that's pretty typical of the way that Nick Fury deals with everything in this film, though. And it's funny because there's so many characters around him saying kind of like, you're washed up. The world's not made for people like you anymore, Fury. We've moved on. Which is kind of like the GoldenEye view of a character like Nick Fury, isn't it? It's like, you know, you're the Cold War relic. The world has moved on. We don't need you anymore. Except the ironic thing is the world of this movie hasn't moved on past a character like Nick Fury. The world seems to bend to his whim, like the fact that he can shoot a lift and that solves the problem. Oh, like the fact that he can get poisoned and should be killed, but his body is able to withstand that for the rest of the length of the movie while he's doing
like,
his action.
That's what I mean, in the sense that he's more like a parody of Nick Fury than actually Nick Fury.
Yeah.
Because, like, he just...
Yeah.
He does whatever he likes and the story works. Like, things that should have zero... That should make zero sense just work out fine for him.
Should we pay tribute to David Hasselhoff in that respect? Because, you know, let's not pretend this is anything but a terrible performance from Hasselhoff, because it's absurd. It really is ridiculous.
Oh, see, I was worried, like, before when you were talking about him, you know, kind of acting off the screen. I thought you were actually being positive about his performance.
No, it's a dreadful, ridiculous kind of parody performance. But having said that, it's enjoyable to watch Hasselhoff being that ridiculous. That's what I found got me through the scenes. I kind of enjoyed the vigor with which he was delivering these obviously terrible lines. He was delivering the kind of zingers at the end of the scene like they'd been written for an Arnold Schwarzenegger $100 million blockbuster in 1992, rather than a Nick Fury cheap knockoff made for TV movie. Like, there's no quality, there's no artistry, there's no intelligence to the zingers that they give Nick Fury, but he delivers them as if they are the most sumptuously written one-liners he could possibly have been given. He's wonderful in that respect.
That's certainly a word you could use.
What was the... it's a long time since I read this out now, but the line that he reads out in...
Sexpionage.
When he meets...
Yeah, she's an old hand at
Contessa
the
Contessa Valentina di Allegro Fontaine. Quite a mouthful when you try and wrap your tongue around it. Don't let the blue blood fool you, Pierce. Val's an old hand at the sexpionage game.
And the thing is, right, this...
It doesn't make any sense!
Firstly, it doesn't make any sense. Secondly, it comes, like, apropos of absolutely nothing. He's literally just met this guy. And it's like, we don't know anything about, really, him or this character who he's talking about, or this character who he's talking to. Like, the viewer has literally just met all three of these characters in this scene. And Pierce, like, is just meeting Fury for the first time, and all of a sudden he comes out with this line that's obviously supposed to be there to imply this, like, shared history between them, but bloody hell, it's ham-fisted.
Do you know what he reminds me a lot of? Kind of like John Barrowman in Arrow. In that, like, the character is so abrasive and kind of immediately unlikable in his kind of brash... I don't feel like he's kind of like a lovable hero that gives a bit... I don't feel like... He doesn't come across like a Tony Stark. It's almost like that the casting of Hasselhoff, in that he's quite... I don't think anyone hates Hasselhoff. I think he's immediately quite likable, but no one has any kind of respect for him as a fine actor. Like you said, this is post the music career and stuff, so, and post Baywatch and all of that. We kind of know who Hasselhoff is, and so you kind of, like, buy the ridiculous nature of this character. You don't really buy him as this gruff asshole, because it's Hasselhoff, so we can kind of just giggle along with the fact that he's saying this stuff.
I will just say, actually, that the ludicrousness of the kind of dialogue, the sort of the cigar chomping lines and the kind of way that he talks, that's actually reasonably faithful to how he is, particularly in the 60s comics. It's just that what works on the page of a 1960s Stan Lee, Jack Kirby and Jim Steranko comic is not necessarily what works on screen in the mouth of David Hasselhoff in 1998, you know.
We should point out, this movie was written supposedly by David S. Goyer,
which means that there is a David Goyer script that is worse than, well, whichever David Goyer script you want to pick. Apparently he has tried to distance himself from it. He said that he wrote a version and it got heavily rewritten, but his name was kept on it.
This came out the same year as Blade, which he also wrote.
I mean, it's notable that this is basically just, like, flat exposition for most of its running time. Like, it reminds me of the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. TV series in a bad way. Although that said, there are bits of this that I think they should have done more stuff like this in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Well, yeah, I mean, like...
Do you mean dialing up the camp? Is that what you mean by that?
Yeah, like, more things like they have... Occasionally they pull out some, like, weird spy gadgets and use them. Like, I didn't know before I watched this film how much aerosol could do.
It is, at least, I mean, like...
Because, like, it can remove disguises, it can let you walk through lasers, like,
but
really
that's the
good
thing.
Stuff.
S.H.I.E.L.D. should be something that has ridiculous technology and gadgets. It's like, that is a key, because S.H.I.E.L.D., even by its very name, comes out of the 1960s, like, ridiculous spy tradition. Like, it's S.H.I.E.L.D. would not exist as a name,
like,
Man from U.N.C.L.E., you know. And Spectre is probably another example. Probably one of the problems with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I mean, is that, it's actually, I mean, of the many problems with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., is that it's, you know, it's its own thing, but that thing is not really S.H.I.E.L.D. as you would imagine the sort of, you know, the key elements of S.H.I.E.L.D. to me. At least this film, the problem with this film is that it takes those elements and rather than doing what it should have done, which is to do it as actually a period piece in the 60s, which obviously they could never afford to do on a TV movie budget, but its problem is that it's being made in 1998 and on a TV movie budget, and so it's just a load of scenes in warehouses with pipes and everyone's wearing black leather jackets, and it's just, you know... But it has at least got... I mean, to its credit, and I did not expect this, and while the effects are terrible, at least they do the helicarrier. I didn't expect that they would do the helicarrier in this, and they do. And it looks awful, but at least they do it.
I mean, I don't even think it looks awful. I think it looks...
Actually, no, the helicarrier doesn't. It's the jet that looks awful in those shots. The helicarrier looks okay,
But, I mean, you get, like, a shot of each, and other than that, it's just people inside them, which is clearly just, like, people on sets. Everything looks like it's... I don't know.
It's so grey.
Yeah, everything, whether it's a scene that's set in a warehouse or not, looks like they're in a warehouse.
Yeah, exactly.
You've put some computer screens up in this warehouse. That's interesting. You talk about all the gadgets and stuff, and it does seem like the film is making up kind of like the technology and stuff as it goes along. I mean, the reason I brought up David S. Goyer is because, because he does dispute having written this, and this really does feel like a film that someone wrote a script for, and then someone else got their hands on it and kind of stripped anything that cost any money out of it, and then kind of wrote some lines that got you from scene A to scene B to scene C. And it does feel like, oh, how would they get out of this thing in this scene? What if we do this? It's like, there's a real big plot hole here. Could we introduce a character who's a psychic? Yeah, let's introduce that character who's a psychic. We haven't really got much for that psychic character to do. She's not really influencing the plot anymore. Well, she's in the script now, it'd be a bit difficult to take her out.
It's like, you know, my favourite. Like,
there's a member of the team here who's a psychic and she doesn't anything. Like, they get into trouble every 5 minutes. She never sees anything coming.
My favourite part of the entire film is that, like, the big moment, like, the thing the film is leading up to, like, the huge character drama for Nick Fury at the end is he has to choose whether they press 6 or 9. Like, that's how he saves the day. He has superior knowledge of whether they should press the button 6 or 9, which he's just guessing. He doesn't know.
He has superior knowledge of whether the psychic is reading an incorrect thought.
He's not psychic. He just, based on the information he's got, which is no information, he picks 6 or 9 correctly.
I can't remember how this film ends.
I mean, I'm sorry for the spoiler.
Yeah.
You don't have to watch the film now. He chooses 6. And the bomb doesn't go off, or the missiles don't go off.
And then the villain escapes. And she goes down a lift in a tube, and Nick Fury says she's halfway to China by now. I'm not entirely sure what is. Has she literally got a tunnel through the earth? I'm not certain. Can they not follow her?
And then there's that weird incesty scene at the end where...
Baron von Strucker actually. But can we actually talk about Andrea von Strucker? Because there's one particular scene that we haven't... I think we've deliberately skipped it over so that we can talk about it, like, towards the end.
You guys, she's the best. She is one of the few members of this, like, of the cast who feel like they're in the same movie as David Hasselhoff. Like,
shall I tell you who she feels like she's in the same movie as? She's in the same movie as Tommy Wiseau.
That's fair. But do you know what I mean? Like, every other character, like, there's a lot of bad performances in this film, but they kind of feel like they're bad just because that's just the quality of the person playing them. Whereas I'm sure Sandra Hess, who I think is best known from her IMDb profile for playing Sonya Blade in Mortal Kombat Annihilation, she is... dialing it up to a level that perhaps even eclipses Hasselhoff.
But I'm not sure how deliberate it is, because it's
really
so bad. Well, this one scene that I'm talking about, it's the scene when she is talking to the Council of Hydra members.
That's
And That scene is just, it's got, there's so much to unpack from that scene, because you've got her just ranting maniacally and just being appalling. But then you have this moment where she's basically is, you know, but the idea is that she's sort of gone off and done her own thing in terms of, you know, getting control of Hydra and determining what Hydra will do in terms of bringing back von Strucker and doing the Death's Head virus and stuff. And the council of evil Hydra members across the globe are appalled by this, largely because they had to wake up early in the morning because of the time difference. And then she basically demonstrates her frightening, you know, superiority to them by bringing out one of the other lieutenants who's from London, apparently, although he doesn't say a line of dialogue, so you don't get to hear his accent. And he's tied to a chair, and you get the... I thought at this point, oh, she's going to unleash the virus on him, yeah. And you're going to get this scene where the virus takes hold and his face transforms and stuff. She's going to do something appalling and they're going to be terrified of her. And she pulls out a gun and she shoots him. But even better than that, she fires four times, and you see at the fourth shot him fly backwards, having been shot. So she missed with the first three shots, and then she shoots him in the head. And then she turns around and goes, does anybody else want to doubt the new direction of things? It's like, you've got a gun. They've all probably got guns. It's not the most terrifying thing they're ever going to have seen. They're international terrorist criminals.
But Seb, the delivery of all of this as well, and there's a reason, if anyone can remember back to this, that I brought her up or alluded to her during our Suicide Squad podcast. Because I claim that she is a better villain than Enchantress. But the reason I was reminded of her to bring up was because even just when she's just walking two or three steps, she seems to walk with her entire body. Her arms always seem to be outstretched, and like with each footstep, she kind of has to like throw half of her body forward because everything is so big and exaggerated. And she feels to me like a villain from a really cheap cartoon, like not one of the good 90s animated cartoons, like I don't know, maybe one of the less successful ones that
the
no one
Ultraverse
remembers,
cartoon.
The kind that you probably watched when you were a kid and forced out of your memory.
There's all the other thing in that scene, and actually it probably sums up why she feels like she's wandered in from a different film, is that during that scene she says, "We are the children of anarchy," and it's like, no, you're Nazis. You're trying to bring about a fascistic world. You're literally the opposite of anarchy.
She also gets some fantastic outfits.
I was going to say, she seems to have a different outfit in every scene.
In every scene, yeah. Apart from she always has that veil over
that
her
scene?
Face.
Yeah, does she, in that scene where she's talking to all of the members on the screens, does she,
I'm pretty sure there's one scene, I think, where she like takes her coat off or something and there's like a different dress beneath it, maybe. Something along those lines.
I'm sure it's that.
I mean, the thing I like most about her is her accent, which veers between French and German.
Well, she is Swiss, so okay. That would explain it, but
do you think that was
intentional? I would have thought that a Swiss person could do a convincing German accent, but she cannot do a convincing German accent.
On that point, one of my favourite subplots from the movie is when she is posing as that other agent. She's posing as a British agent. I think
she's German because they're in Berlin. It's a German Interpol agent.
Yeah. Right, okay, but is it a German Interpol agent? But the German Interpol agent herself is clearly being dubbed, but she's not being dubbed by Sandra Hess. She's been dubbed with a different voice.
I don't think it's dubbed in order to, you know, for it to be Sandra Hess's voice. I think it's just one of several examples in the film where they've gone back and done ADR, because there's at least two other examples where I could see that a character's name that was being said did not match the mouth moves. Because it's right at the very start when the guy playing Quatermain says Baron Wolfgang von Strucker, and he does not, his lips do not make that movement when he says it at all. It's bizarre. There is a lot of dodgy ADR in this film.
Yeah. I thought she was fantastic.
I mean,
that's what I mean.
I think she's the only part of the film
that's going to be around the corner.
I think she's the only part of the film that goes into so bad it's almost entertaining. But in that one scene, it's just, this is just laughable. Honestly, I don't make the Room comparison idly. Like that one scene that I'm talking about, I have seen nothing like that scene since I saw The Room honestly. It's just...
And that scene's not... It doesn't seem like it's being played for laughs. I mean, she has an outrageous costume and she is acting ridiculously over the top. But when she shoots him in the chest and says, you know, and says that about, you know, you question my power. Now, it doesn't... It feels like it's being presented so you as an audience member go, oh, yeah, well, the rest of those people aren't going to mess with her now. Yeah, yeah, fine, okay. It doesn't feel like it's being played for you to go, oh, well, that's patently ridiculous. She is absurd. It just feels like they think they're doing a comic book villain. Mm. But it's weird that you get that kind of stuff, but also you get this... So they always look at the scene where Alexander Pierce is showing himself to be ridiculous, and he says, oh, don't worry, I was the head of my class, I'm trained in silent killing, and then immediately fails to take down the guy and gets wiped out. And that's quite funny. Like, it's a dumb, easy, generic setup.
Can I... That seemed
quite
weird.
Funny, and it's the film being aware of what it's doing.
That scene actually contains what I think is the most bizarre moment in the film, which is Nick Fury apologises to an actual Nazi for shooting him.
What?
Like, Hydra agents are Nazis, and just in case, you know, this film isn't trying to move away from that because they've got red armbands with the Hydra logo on, so it's like there's no getting away from the fact that this is Nazi Hydra. And, yeah, Pierce tries to attack the guy and it doesn't work. So then Fury punches him and then he shoots him. And then he says sorry as the guy's falling down. It's like, why are you apologising to a Hydra agent?
It is bizarre.
I think that's about as far in the movie as I can remember. I know I watched the whole thing, but I really honestly struggle to remember anything.
Well, the remainder of the film is them looking at a computer screen and trying to figure out... Oh, no, that bit is before... Thingy kills the life model decoy, and then it turns out to be a life model decoy because it's Chekhov's life model decoy. But from then on, it is literally them just trying to figure out a password. That's the rest of the film. They're trying to figure out a 5-digit password. Maybe you did.
Yeah, it's possible. It is possible. I do remember at various points in this film, which, given that it is a TV movie, it has act breaks, and so kind of occasionally when I saw an act break, I was like, I wonder how far we are now. I'll just click and look. We're only half an hour in. Are you kidding me?
It's not a long film.
It's 90 minutes long, but it's
90 minutes that feels like about 2.5 hours. Yeah. I assumed I was about an hour and a quarter in when I was 45 minutes in. It was like halfway through and I was like, bloody hell.
I mean, there's one thing I want to... I don't know, how close are we to the end here?
Probably not a huge amount. But there's not too much to dig into this one. It's a nice one to ease us back into Cinematic Universe because there's really not too much to dig into with Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Could you guys think of any interesting underlying themes or anything the movie was trying to say or any interesting camera work, maybe some nice cinematography?
There was a lot of Dutch, wasn't
nice
there?
Little musical flourishes.
A lot of Dutch on the camera.
Yeah.
Like, that's the TV movie. We want to be widescreen, but we can't, so we're going to tilt the camera a bit to make the most of what we've got.
Got to get those angles. Yeah. What were you actually going to say, though, James?
The thing I spent the entire film doing was going, can I make this fit into MCU continuity? Like, how much do you have to hammer it into shape for this to be legit? Because, Joe, I don't know if you know in the comics, but the white Nick Fury is the father of black Nick Fury.
I mean, I've heard you say this in a number of times, but I've just chosen not to believe
it. It's true. It's how they got the Black Nick Fury into the regular Marvel Universe was establishing that he was the illegitimate son of... Or possibly legitimate son. He was the hidden son of white Nick Fury.
How?
He met a black woman and had sex with her. And, I mean, I don't want to go into full detail, but then the kid was born.
Why? I mean, is that still the case now? Or is... Black Nick Fury, the ultimate Nick Fury, or has he just disappeared?
Post Secret Wars, they might have retconned that slightly. Like, I don't think they want to go into it too much.
No, it's bad. It's real bad.
So basically, I don't think there's a lot in this film that you could not explain away and still have it be canon. Like, you could say, "Oh, that's Alexander Pierce's son," and like. there are some of the Howling Commandos who show up.
Yeah.
You can say, well, maybe they just went into S.H.I.E.L.D. when they were older. And like, if you assume this is set in the 90s, like 10 years before Iron Man, I think you can just about make it work. And that is my intention.
No, because no one wants to, James.
I know,
no,
I'll tell you why, actually. The one thing that means it doesn't work is that Werner von Strucker showed up in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but he dies in this one.
Oh, Baron von Strucker as well.
Well, yeah, but there's nothing... Like, Baron von Strucker's in Age of Ultron, but he doesn't die.
Ah, so it's literally only the death that you're calling into question.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That seems remarkably generous of you, James.
I think a competent writer could explain away everything except the fact that Werner von Strucker has died twice. That's impossible to explain.
Okay, well, I think it's only fair to our listeners as well as much as our own sanity, because if we bang on for any longer about this film, we're just going to be talking in circles, because it's basically what we've said on repeat, isn't it? This is a ridiculous movie, but I feel like it's... I'll tell you what, I wouldn't tell anyone to go out and watch this movie, but if you can find a couple of clips on YouTube, or if you can just kind of like fast forward through it and kind of like, if a scene looks like it might be interesting to you, watch that for 2 minutes and then skip forward another 20. Like,
I mean,
that's the way to watch this movie.
It's kind of hard to watch anyway, isn't it? Because it appears to have been entirely redacted from the Marvel's cinematic output.
Mm.
Like, you can't buy it digitally anywhere.
I purchased a physical copy.
Exactly. I also did that and then watched it on YouTube, where it is available in 6 parts or 7 parts.
No, there is a full video up on YouTube.
I saw a lot of full videos in like Polish or Spanish dubbing.
Oh, that's possible. I did not watch it in that.
But yeah, if you want to watch it, it's on YouTube.
Mm.
Yeah. Or you could purchase it like I did.
For £5 on DVD.
Yeah.
Yeah,
never
it's £5 and not
back.
Getting back.
But yeah, do you have anything before we finish? Any other little things that you'd like to mention? We haven't mentioned the psychic very much, but I'm not sure that she needs discussing hugely. Any particular moments or lines or?
Nick Fury smokes. Marvel heroes aren't allowed to smoke anymore.
That's true. He smokes. We should have talked about that. He smokes in every single scene. Every line is said through cigar.
Again, though, comics accurate. Before Marvel banned smoking in their comics, which is a fairly... Like, some people hate that. I think it's a completely rational and reasonable thing to do.
Do you remember when we were talking about and the mask and how Jim Carrey had pulled off the remarkable feat of being able to talk through those fake teeth?
Yeah.
But yeah, so I just think it's just as much a remarkable achievement that David Hasselhoff is able to be coherent throughout chomping on that cigar in every scene, because he literally doesn't take it out of his mouth while he's talking. So I think you've got to bow down to him in that respect.
Well, at least there is one respect.
But that was Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. So, guys, what comic books would you like to recommend me based on this movie? Bad ones, I can only assume.
No, quite the opposite. I'll go with the obvious one, which is the collection of the Jim Steranko S.H.I.E.L.D. material, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. It will be gone by the time this goes out, but Joe, if you go on Comixology like now, you can get this complete collection for £2.49, but the sale ends tomorrow rather than $13.99. For completeness sake, for anyone who wants to track it down, it's issues 151 to 168 of Strange Tales, which sounds like a lot, but every issue is only half an issue's length, because Strange Tales was Doctor Strange and Nick Fury stories at like running simultaneously, so it was half an issue. Then it's issues 1 to 3 and 5 of Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Basically what happened was Stan Lee and Jack Kirby were doing it, and then a couple of issues in, Jim Steranko came in to start drawing it, and then he took over as writer-artist. And it's just basically, I mean, it's fantastic experimental comics. It starts out quite standard 60s, and then it goes more and more interesting and experimental and crazy 60s spy stuff. Like, not a million miles away from something like Casanova, let's say. But a little bit less complex, but still really interesting. And this is where all of the characters and stuff from this film come from, basically.
Excellent. James, have you got something similar?
I wouldn't say similar. I've got something good.
Okay.
So earlier I sort of alluded to this Nick Fury parody. He is a character called Dirk Anger. And he was originally supposed to be Nick Fury, but the tone of the book meant that the writer was told not to use this character at the risk of completely obliterating his usefulness in the future. So the book I'm recommending you is called Next Wave. It's by Warren Ellis and Stuart Immonen, and it's about this character called Dirk Anger making a kind of S.H.I.E.L.D.-esque organization, and Next Wave are his superhero team, which consists of a bunch of weird sort of vaguely obscure Marvel characters who, I mean, I can't think that you'll be familiar with any of them off the top of my head, but by the end of these 12 issues you will love them. And I'm like, admittedly, they're all single issue stories, so I could recommend any one, but as soon as you start reading, I think you will just go straight through to the end.
Okay.
So Next Wave issues 1 to 12, that's the complete run. Warren Ellis and Stuart Immonen, it's fantastic.
So you've got okay, you've got nearly 500 pages of Steranko Shield and then 12 issues of Next Wave.
Yeah, we thought we'd ease you back in.
I think you've got about 800 pages to read this week.
Wow, okay. Well, we'll see how I get on with that. Okay, we'll move on to our final section now, which is the pitch. And this is a fairly simple one. The great, fantastic actress Olivia Colman this week said that she would love to play a Marvel villain. So it's an easy question because I think we all agree that she should play one. Which one should she play? And Seb, we'll start with you.
So this one immediately came to mind, such that actually we discussed this over email, which we don't usually do with the pitch, but it came up as a conversation topic beforehand. The immediate thing that comes to mind is that she should play a female Dr. Octopus in a Tom Holland Spider-Man film. Now, there was a female Dr. Octopus called Carolyn Trainor in the 90s, but I don't think she should be that character because I think she would work so well just as a gender-flipped version of Otto Octavius. So I think she should be Dr. Ophelia Octavius, and just like, because I think that's a character who Alfred Molina played it so well that if you're going to recast, you should move in a completely different direction. And I think Olivia Colman would play that role superbly.
Yeah, that makes an awful lot of sense. James, can you be a female Dr. Octopus?
Maybe. One of the things that Olivia Colman said was that she doesn't think there are that many middle-aged female villains in Marvel, in the Marvel Universe. And the only one I could think of, aside from Marganucci, who she doesn't really fit, is Cassandra Nova, who is the evil twin of Professor Xavier from Grant Morrison's new X-Men run. So, if you can imagine Olivia Colman with a bald head and a kind of ruthless psychic streak, who in the storyline... No, I won't tell you that, because you'll have to read New X-Men at some point.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not going to spoiler it, but that's who I think she should be, Professor Xavier's sort of evil twin.
Right. So, one thing holds you back there, which is that she's not the right age for either James McAvoy or Patrick Stewart. I think she's probably right in the middle of the two of them. Although, on the other hand, that does mean complete universe reboot, which I do like. But no, I think female Dr. Octopus is kind of perfect. You were onto a loser as soon as you had to not think of that character, James.
Yeah.
So, Seb, you win the pitch this week. Honestly, as soon as you suggest it.
I think this should be a shared victory because James had also had this exact idea when it came up in idle conversation.
Hey, I'll leave that up to the two of you to fight out between. If you want to share, you can share.
No, I refuse to share.
Okay, the win's all yours.
Victory or death, that's my motto.
Okay, well, that is it for this week's podcast. If you're enjoying the show, then please do subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, or your podcast app of choice, and support us on Patreon at patreon.com/cinematicuniverse. You can find more episodes of the show at cinematicmultiverse.com, and you can get in touch via Facebook, on Twitter, at @CU_podcast, or send us an email to cinematicuniversepod@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Are you a God-fearing man, Senator? That is such a strange phrase. I've always thought of God as a teacher, a bringer of light, wisdom, and understanding. You see, I think what you really fear is me. Me and my kind. The Brotherhood of Mutants. Cinematic Universe returns in 2 weeks' time with X-Men.